Okay, I believe the noon hour has arrived, and we will call our meeting to order. This is the fourth quarterly meeting of our Board of Regents, and I'll ask Secretary Higdon to have a roll call.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair Bale.
Present.
Regent Ball.
Present.
Regent Brinkley.
Present.
Regent Arts.
Present.
Regent Higdon. Present. Regent Henson.
Present.
Regent Johnson.
Here.
Regent Mayer.
Present.
Regent McKinney.
Present.
Regent Nichols.
Present.
Regent Porter.
Present.
Mr. Chair, we have a full house today.
Very good. And it looks like we do have a full house, and we have some visitors we'd like to welcome. Point of information, last night was the annual recognition of Philanthropist of the Year, and one of our own, George and C.J. Nichols, were recognized for their extreme generosity, and I wish I had on tape his little talk last night, but it was inspiring, and they have certainly set a great example for anyone with a philanthropic spirit. We had a meeting earlier this morning that I think hopefully is setting a new precedent born out of trying to have a little more collaboration with faculty and staff, and President Caboni and our provost met with our staff regent, our faculty regent, our Senate president, and our staff council president, along with myself and the vice chair, and we had a nice informal group meeting discussion of lots of items that I think will weave their way into meetings like this eventually. So, we have several minutes from May, August, and October, which we have had sent to us recently, and I can now entertain a motion for approval of those minutes.
So moved.
Motion, I hear second.
Second.
Motion and a second for approval of the minutes from May 11th, August 3rd, and October 26th. Any discussion, comments? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Minutes are accepted. We will go into the executive committee. We have several action items. First involves approval of some rooms. And Todd, do you want to say anything about the athletic rooms that are being named after individuals, the Shirleys, and Mitrotto. Anyway, you've got some rooms that are, you've got some donations.
Probably actually read that. Joe Mitrotto, his family had made a contribution that would benefit multiple sports, specifically football, volleyball, and he has a couple areas he's thinking about for specific needs. Shirley May will go in the men's basketball offices, and then Mike and Belmont will name the women's basketball offices.
This was brought up at our committee meeting, so entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and second for approval of the designated name. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. All right. This item was discussed at our committee meeting, and it involves ownership of the property at 1660 Mimosa Alley. One wish to make a motion.
So moved.
Motion to approve.
Second.
And a second to accept ownership of the Mimosa Alley property. Any discussion? No. not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. And then the next item was not discussed at the October 26th committee meetings, and it involves a lease agreement on the 1880 US 31 W bypass.
Mr. Chair, if I could make a point of clarification, you all did have a special call meeting about that, so you don't have to have a separate discussion.
Okay. Anybody have anything to say about that? If not, we'll entertain a motion to approve that. Motion.
Second.
And a second. Okay. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye. Opposed, like sign. All right. Next item involves a presentation. I think we have Dr. Graves here. Give a presentation on the Commons project.
Good afternoon. If we could get the PowerPoint up for Kendall. Thank you very much. A steering committee was formed last summer to actualize President Comboni's vision for the WKU Commons outlined in his investiture speech last April. The vision is to create an intellectual hub that invigorates engagement, stimulates learning, creates a space where ideas are shared and created and shared. The bid process went out over the summer, and this project was awarded to Gensler Architects along with Luckett and Farley, who are here today. And we're here to share where we're at in this process and the design concept moving forward. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce David Brose and Brian Watson to present where we're at.
Thank you very much. We're with Gensler Architects. We're based out of the Chicago office. We lead our education group for the firm. We're a global design firm that focuses on everything from office buildings to mixed-use sports stadiums to educational facilities. So we're proud to be part of the team and partner with our local partners with Luckett Farley based out of Louisville. The process that we've entered into in the project has been a very inclusive project process because the ultimate vision of the project is to be very inclusive. So we have had multiple conversations. We've sent out digital surveys. We even had boards up in the student union for students to walk by and make comments on and give us their positives and negatives. So it's been a very positive process as far as collecting student information, as far as what they want to see that kind of enhances the vision that we were given to when we were awarded the project. We also have a core group of people from the university that we took on a design safari. There weren't quite safari hats that everyone wore, but I am thinking about adding that for our future ones. But what's amazing about the project is that what you're looking to build in this library renovation is really one of a kind. And it hasn't been done in multiple places in the past. And so what we did is we actually took a tour through some libraries, but we also took a tour through the newest food halls that are being created. We also took a tour through corporate training facilities. And by seeing such a wide variety of disparate projects, we are able to develop a common vocabulary that allows us to say, we like these things about this project, we like these things about this project, but most importantly, we don't like these things about that project. And that's allowed us then to kind of enter into this visioning and concept design process, which is where we're at today, with such a collegial a process that we're going through.
Right. And through all of that visioning process, we came up with a series of guiding principles for the next one. So I think the important thing here is that these guiding principles that we developed as part of this vision really align with the strategic plan of the university, which is really important. So the thing we really simplified is this idea of invite, engage, grow, and radiate. And that starts with this idea of how can we reflect the diverse students that are coming to school here? How can we prepare them for a career and use this project to be at the heart of that? And then how can we expand the outreach? How can we look beyond the borders of the university and connect with the state and the region as a whole? And how can this project be at the heart of that as well?
So this is the space we've been given. It is right now a very intensive stack project, which is very typical on college campuses across the country. We're at a great influx of of time where the book is still valuable, but so is the social interaction spaces that need to happen in a library as well. And in the old days, it was accommodated in these little four-person reading tables. And in the process, especially through Design Safari, it has changed in evolution of how that interaction happens. But behind that ceiling that has such a unique pitch to it is this. The old basketball hall is still there beneath what has been added in. And so our process is to really understand what was removed, what was kept, and how does that align with the program that we're developing for this project. And I also we also realize that on academic campuses, sometimes things move very slowly. And so I have this amazing image of the Roman times. Because people often ask me, where did the lecture hall come from? The two are so very closely related, even down to the fact, and if this wasn't so grainy, there's a guy in the back that's actually sleeping. There's two people in the middle row that are talking, all while the teacher's trying to get the teaching done. But while academia at times may seem like it doesn't move quickly, the world is changing. And so if you were one of the people that were shopping at Radio Shack in 1995, and you bought everything that's on this front flyer. It included a cell phone, it includes a video recorder, it includes a speaker, it includes a camcorder, a Tandy computer. All together would have been a little bit over $10,000, of which now we all fit in our pocket and we have in front of us. So the world is rapidly evolving, and our responsibility to you and to the project is to create a space that won't be that room for that Radio Shack equipment bought in the 1995s, but how does it be a constantly evolving and future-ready space? Because if you think back to the time that this field house was converted to Elm Library, the classrooms probably look like the image in the top left corner, where now the spaces we're building look like the top right corner. The workplace probably looked like the bottom left corner, where now the bottom right corner is what workplace looks like for where your students are graduating into. And so in reality, what we often like to talk about is that nothing is new, but that it's all just remixing what we already know. But the true challenge of this project is that the places that we visit on the Design Safari is not what we want to match. We want to go beyond that. Because if we simply match what's built today or what's predicted in the next year or two, we will be behind when the rapid evolution continues to happen, like I talked about with that iPhone. So our goal with the vision, with the process, with the design, is to really go from just what is future to what is truly transformational, and so that we're ready when everyone else catches up.
Yeah, as Dave mentioned, you know, this is a project that really doesn't have a lot of precedent, and it really starts with this unlikely pairing, this idea of social space and intellectual space. So that starts with a lot of food service. That's really one of the major components here. And then the traditional learning space. So what happens when you start to combine the two and really use the two to play off of each other and make each other better? So we really looked at this idea of a commons as an ecosystem of social and intellectual spaces. And then this idea that started is harness the social and power the intellectual. And that's at the heart of this building, I think, is how can we best do that? So when we're looking at the footprint of Helm, as it is today, it's really a series of these really thin, disconnected floor plates. So really, I think, as part of our process, the first starting point is just changing our perspective and thinking of this, you know, back as that shell, that historic space that contains these programs.
Just a quick point of reference, the basketball floor is actually on this level. It's on level two. So there's actually two levels below that we're able to use for this program requirements for the project.
Right. Yeah, and kind of the basic way to look at these programs is you could easily say, well, the food is on the bottom and then the intellectual space is on the top. But really the value here is starting to mix these up and starting to think about this as a series of spaces that are connected and that play off of each other and that are not intentionally separated. So when you look at the program, it's really a mix between the two. You know, we've gone through a pretty intensive programming process. This is really a high-level version of that, but it gives a sense of the types of spaces in the building. And a lot of that is commons areas, which are really these flexible learning spaces, and then dining space. And then there's a lot of support spaces, academic support, and then space for the folks that are running the library. So these all come together, and that's where really this project really sings is how these start to interact and work with each other.
And about half the space is open collaborative space, which will allow for a pretty amazing environment when you get in there. And then we begin to understand how the program fits. And so right now, the three bubbles are beginning to suggest floors. But it's all about that remixing. Our goal in this project is that when those food stations are closed because the demand doesn't need it, that the building doesn't feel closed, that it's not just a mall grape that closes and you see the counter beyond, but that there always is an activity and an alignment to the space. You can choose to study at any place at any of the commons, whether it's a dining commons or an intellectual commons, and that it all becomes intermixed, as this bubble diagram might suggest. And what's powerful is, you know, when we were first getting engaged with the project, the concept isn't to create another student union. The concept is to really create that intellectual hub. And I love that infinity diagram, and that if you think about all the activities that are happening in your current student union and the opportunities that can happen in Helm, if you create this infinity diagram between the two spaces, you have the ability to create this energy that can up the campus a little bit. So that it's all about intellectual and social. It just happens to be that there's a couple focused areas of it on your campus.
Right, and then when you zoom into the building itself, we have this connection between Helm and Cravens. And really when you think about those, one is there's a lot of connections that are already happening on campus with how people move. So part of our task is to strengthen those and make this an essential part of every student's daily life as they're moving around the hill and through the academic part of campus. The other is just how do these spaces play off of each other. So thinking of Cravens as really this place where the books live and it's kind of a hub for knowledge, whereas Helm is this idea of a blog. It's a much more dynamic space where you're creating knowledge, and that's where all of this is happening. So the two actually work together and kind of play off of each other as well.
It's like a perfect unison of spaces. What used to be social with the basketball hall is the social aspect, again, of the library. And the Cravens is the book repository that that a lot of campuses want to have. You already had it in your existing facility, so it's a great that it's an opportunity for interior renovation to bring it back to that.
So part of this is also just looking at how do we think about the impact of the building on the campus around it. So one of the biggest things is connected to that now. Right now the building is pretty solid and kind of disconnected. So how do we really make it clear where you enter, how you connect, how you can see in and out? And then beyond that, how do you use this project as a way to connect up to the hill and really rethink the way that Helm engages with the campus and connects with the historic core? So really the point that we're at in the project right now is we've come up with a series of conceptual ideas and drivers. And those really focus around, you know, what are these connections? How do you enter the building? How do you move through the building? And then what's the conceptual way that we start to arrange a program within the space? So we've come up with a series of these concept schemes that are in development, you know, ways of approaching whether we add on, whether we integrate spaces within the footprint of the building, how do we really start to approach the spaces?
And the true opportunity, if you remember that infinity diagram that we showed with the university, is to think about the campus as an infinity diagram to the region. And how can you let this project be the catalyst to increase your presence in the region and be the source of innovation? And that's our excitement for being part of this project. And we'd be open for questions that you might have. Let me give you a timeline. So we are just finishing concept design. So in the grand scheme of design, we're in probably first quarter of a football game. So we have come up with, we've been able to go through all the program requirements. We've assigned them to space to understand that it definitely fits in the building as far as the aspirations and the vision of the program. We're in the process of getting that priced to confirm that we're moving in the right direction. By the beginning of the new year, we'll have pencil to paper actually showing walls and doors where it all is out within the space, so that by mid-January we'll be coming back here with the core group and doing a design presentation as far as where the space is heading from an architectural perspective. And then we're on track to still be open by the end of 2020 for student use, probably the first quarter of 2021.
Is there any questions?
Yeah, I have one question. What, where else have you employed this particular concept, and what has the effect been, if you know, from student enrollment, student retention, student engagement?
That's a great question. We've recently finished a business school where they envisioned a certain growth potential. And 3 years out, having built the building, they're already talking about building a second building. So new facilities typically gain excitement. It definitely is part of the prospective student path that students go through. And it is a forward vision into what the university wants to be. Whenever we've built these, there's definitely been an uptick as far as just interest and excitement. We had a student center once that was built at an inner city school university, and they had a donor that came forward and said, I want to build a student center for my students. And the campus facilities and architect were saying, well, our students just don't work that way. They don't want a student center. And the day that the door opened, thousands of students were passing through this facility on a daily basis. And the campus just began to say, well, where were all these students before? And so it began to be this kind of hub of activity and buzz of activity. And I think that this project definitely has that, especially on this part of campus, which may be lacking of those types of facilities. It has a really opportunity to kind of just pull students out that you don't even think that might just go home, right? They might go back to their apartment or something. Gives them a reason to stick around. You know, the other big design driver that we didn't mention so far, but it was all about faculty and student interaction too. And how do you take that interaction out of the faculty office or out of the classroom? You've talked a lot about the coffee shop downtown that everyone just kind of goes to, and that's where students and faculty impromptu meet too. And the vision of this is that that's the campus version. It's a place that faculty might choose to go together and have a conversation. A student sees them, and all of a sudden they're engaged in that conversation.
Based on what you just shared, have you looked at the increased traffic to the student center since it was recently renovated within a number of years, and then the potential impact this has on that? So I know what you're saying, where you're saying I'm trying to create a new environment on this side.
Yeah, right.
Have we looked at the impact that it has across years? I mean, I see this infinity thing. I get that.
Yeah, yeah.
But we still have a set number of students.
Yep.
So if I'm not going at the student center and I'm not going here, then I'm, you know, there's really not a replacement.
I think the thought is that the food offerings that are here are replacing food offerings that are in another location as part of the campus right now. And so I think it's a one-to-one on food offerings. So it's not like we're...
It's actually less about the food and more about the identity of students going through.
So this is still part of the library. So what the libraries have sorely needed over time is collaborative study.
Okay.
We are very much lacking places where students can get together, work on group projects, maybe grab a bite to eat, and then work with their group on different projects that they might have. Creating that third space on campus where people can engage with each other, share ideas, kind of, I know a lot of my great ideas or chance meetings in parking lots and hallways have such an impact on what I do here on campus, and this space I envision serving that type of purpose as well. I don't think it displaces anybody, but I think it would add and enhance what we have already here. In particular, to
computer
student, another.
Because, again, the concern is, just like your example that you said, where all these students
are,
well, they're actually going somewhere now.
Yeah.
So that collaboration may be at the student center, they may be at their dorm. I'm just trying to think, as we think through that, are we also trying to factor that in and say, okay, as this goes on, maybe we can even adjust things that happen somewhere else? That's the, I guess, thought process.
So one of, Regent Nichols, is a great question. One of the issues this is designed to address is a dining facility in Garrett that is completely overwhelmed at some point for some narrow portion of the day, but then completely underutilized for the rest of the day. And so if we're able to take, we know where they are. They're at Panda Express getting one chicken. And if we can help them have other sets of opportunities and shift them into a place that is more intellectually connected, I think that's a win. The other is, and this is absolutely designed to attract and be a sticky space. So we don't want to just get people to come. We want to get people to come and stay. And that portion of our audience is the commuter population. Right. So if you think about where parking has moved in relation to the first year village, there's a commuter lot that's now on top of the hill that will create a traffic path to the top of the hill. The hope is that you create this lively, engaging space where they take a meal, they stay. and it becomes sticky. And so the Garrett space, which if you haven't been in, looks about like it looked in 1952, will be what's, this place will happen there. The other is that we've already felt it a little bit with Hilltopper Hall. There's a dining facility that opened there that doesn't just serve the folks that live in Hilltopper, but also it's beginning to pull away from the top of the hill. This will be part of that too. But yeah, what we don't want to create is an just a shifting of bodies and an underutilization of space. We got to grow the pie.
And that's what I was thinking is just as you go through this, you know, there are people going to shift, and as they shift, what happens to the other spaces? And if you're making sure this is a comprehensive approach, you look at what we're doing, then it makes more sense when you're doing this. And I get the intellectual, but I'll tell you, I spend a lot of time at the library in college. It had nothing to do with the books there, and nothing to do with study. There was a young lady there. As long as she was there, I was there. I know that's not what we're creating.
But, I think that still happens.
Yeah. But I do know that as we're thinking about this, I'd hate to see us do something that's great and very successful, but then has a negative impact on other parts of the campus, because that's not the intent.
We've seen success on other campuses, too, that when we create environments that are like the ones on the right, that there's almost like a toolkit that is then modular that can be inferred, okay. Right? At the end of the day, what's remarkable about what's happened in the last 10 years of design, I would say, is if you would have approached us with this program 20 years ago, our answer would be completely different, and mainly because of the rapid evolution and iteration that's happened in the furniture industry. So on the program, we have, you know, kind of like a collaboration space. In the old days, we would have built you four walls and put a door on it and put a table inside. Today, there's so many furniture product offerings that can accommodate that same function that responds to today and tomorrow's students so much better. It's not behind a closed door. What's great about that is it saves money, because you're not putting in more light switches, more air, you know, special air conditioning ducts. And you also can move it and repivot it. So there will be objects like that in this project that you say, man, this setting is like, the students gravitate towards it. We could put it elsewhere. And that's where we've seen it successful, where then it's not like we're just creating a shining star and then everything else is a dimmer. You can take certain aspects of that furniture and put it in other spaces on your campus as well.
I would just like to add, at the beginning of the concept proposal, we kept talking about how these spaces would transcend over time, being flexible, adaptable, not creating just specific niches for specific purposes, but over time they can adapt and morph as our needs adapt and more as well.
Everything I've read over the last few years has said for bricks and mortar universities, places like ours, to be successful, it's got to be because of meaningful student faculty and student engagement, and this appears to promote that. I like that aspect of it a lot.
It's definitely been a key driver in all the conversations.
Yeah.
Julie?
Yeah.
What will happen to Garrett Hall? Garrett? I'm just going to ask that question, and also about the pedestrian traffic, because if you try to drive down the hill like I did this morning, there is a little bit of a, I sit there quite a long time, and I just was curious how to encourage students to walk over. That road's a little busy, a little dangerous, normal, I'm saying it right, normal drive, it's a little dangerous, a little busy, so I was just trying to figure out how you all going to manage that as well, because I'm sure that's part of the plan.
Absolutely, it's been absolutely, from the outset, part of the conversation. That this gives us an opportunity to, in some ways, restore the crown of the hill, College Heights, to what President Cherry initially envisioned, right? A place that was much more pedestrian-focused. And so trying to figure out, is there a way to separate pedestrian traffic from vehicular traffic? Because right now, as you spend, if you spend any time on the hill, or more importantly, trying to get from College High Hall to the library, you're walking through parking lots, across streets, and it's unsafe, but it's also not terribly pleasant. And so if they're in the process, if there's a way to think about how we separate those out, that's absolutely something that we're going to work toward. At the same time, ensuring that faculty and staff and 18-wheelers that need to serve as van meter still have access and entry points to those places and egress as well. But you can imagine traffic patterns will necessarily change. The other is around buildings being at the end of their useful life, and the Garrett Conference Center is likely there.
And so, again, that gives us another opportunity at the top of the hill to think about, is there a replacement, or perhaps even more importantly, how do you create a communal space that is part of the historic and academic core where folks engage, and it continues to accelerate our competitive advantage, that we are a total college community, the most collegiate of campuses in the Commonwealth, and we need to continue to push in that direction. So that will evolve over time, but is the right question. And we'll find a way to appropriately honor President Garrett and that legacy and history. At the same time, we may get the vista to the southeast reopened from the top of the hill, which would be something marvelous to reclaim for the faculty and staff that spend their time and their days up there.
Steve?
Yeah. So I 100% see the need for a space like this on campus. I mean, I would have loved to hear that it's going to happen after I graduate. But one of my main concerns, especially, correct me if I'm wrong, but my timelines, this and the Freshman Village is going to be finishing around like the same time. So one of my main concerns is like that direct cost to students. So we're probably going to see an increase in housing with the new Freshman Village and adjusting the cost there. So where do we see the cost of this going, and what's the estimated price tag on that as of now? I know you said you're going to be doing some pricing over the winter.
And you'll remember this is part of the Aramark contract.
Okay.
And this is, that's what enables us to do this project. It's one of the reasons that commuters are focused so heavily in the design. Mm-hmm. And my good colleagues have heard me say that there is a project budget within which we will work, mm-hmm. period. And so this is paid for, and hopefully will increase the revenue through Aramark, so it won't be an additional charge. And yes, it is absolutely designed, and for those who are thinking about enrolling the hill on fall 20, a freshman village, a brand new commons, and other exciting things happening, it's a competitive pitch for us in the marketplace.
Thank you. Well, I'm sort of interested in, you said you wanted to prepare the space for tomorrow. So when I look at what students do, right, books, it's sort of the last resort they're going to go to. And so you have anything in mind in terms of, like, data throughput for this building being somehow higher rate than anywhere else? Are there accommodations made, for example, for high-end 3D visualization, gaming, whatever the students do these days? Is this something you have any offering?
So when we did the design safari in Chicago, no matter what institution we went to, we heard some of the very similar things. You can never get enough outlets. You can never get enough whiteboards for people to work on and offer Wi-Fi. Those were the three huge criteria when, no matter what institution we went to. And we look at, for the future, how we look at gathering data, working with data, data visualization. That's some of the things we've talked about in providing some services within the libraries, and how we reach out to future needs as it becomes a growing aspect in anybody entering the workforce. So we have paid special attention to those type of things, but making sure that we get the base requirements as well at the same time. Does that answer your question?
I agree. I think we need a fatter pipe, right? More data throughput. And the other thing that they didn't mention that is in the space is a venue for esports, which obviously needs a big pipe, but also the social space. So one of the differentiators for us is we have an incredible esports competitive team, and we're going to have a space that just benefits them, but honors the kind of their place on campus. But the corollary to that, or the outgrowth of that, is that's for competitive gaming. But that same the size pipe you need for that also becomes available to all the other data needs in the space.
Because there still will be a computer lab that's in there, and meeting some of those advanced needs in research as we look at digital scholarship, digital humanities, those type of aspects.
And I assume you all look at this, especially if you've looked at some of the companies, but as the company I used to work for, we went through this process of trying to update and get these open spaces, only to find out that some people with those open spaces says, where can I go be alone? And so being able to create that I could go to a space where there's only two of us or three of us.
Yeah.
I just saw Google or somebody put in the new mobile telephone booths now that you can just go into.
The old London
you're thinking through that process as well because we're finding is that people still have that. People are migrating. I want the social space, but I also want the privacy.
Absolutely. So we typically do post-occupancy surveys. We come through and we evaluate the space 6 months or a year after the space is completed. And on some clients, we even talk about doing an 80-20 rule with the furniture purchases, in that it's not quite like campus planning where you don't put sidewalks in and see where people walk and then you put the sidewalks there. You actually have to give people furniture to sit in to understand how they're working with it. But sometimes we buy 80% of the furniture at move-in, and it's properly spread. It's not like 20% of the building is empty. But at your post-occupancy, you actually walk through and you say, man, everyone's using this setup here, and no one's using that setup. And so at that point during the post-occupancy, we'll actually recommend moving some stuff and say, well, that's not working there probably because of these reasons. Let's move it here. This one's doing really well. Let's go buy 10 more of these. Because ultimately, the students will tell if they want, you know, large feasting table collaboration zones like are in all the food halls right now, or if they want more private social spaces. Our goal is to have a balanced portfolio of space like that. But you're absolutely correct. I would say the number one post-occupancy feedback we get is we could use a little bit more private space.
Don't forget, we are a library. We're going to be very sensitive to learning styles, learning needs, different types of environments for different
students. Mr. President, why don't you have the last word?
Richard Bell, in addition to being a library, I want to put in my pitch for food as well. And so, yes, it will be a library, but one of the pushes that I know the group has been working on is how do you create a space that has unique dining? And our partners at Aramark have been working really hard and will continue to work hard with us to identify locally branded food options. So you have you can imagine having the ability to go to a Spencer's Coffee in the Commons, a Double Dog's in the Commons, a Hattie B's Hot Chicken in the Commons, or whatever our, not that I have a particular interest in that, or whatever it is our students and our faculty really want to have available to them. But essentially, how do you create that relationship with the local community, but also create something that doesn't feel like a national chain parachuting in, but really is about us that elevates the space. And so the whole thing is about continuing to push on student engagement, on deep engagement between faculty and students, and also, to be candid, driving food revenue that helps pay for a brand new re-envisioned library and dining space for the campus.
Well, we thank our architects for being here, and Suzanne, thank you for the presentation. We'll look forward to updates as this project comes along.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. That concludes the business of the executive committee, and if everyone's okay to proceed on, I'll ask our vice chairman, Finance and Budget Committee.
Okay. We have three action items that were approved during the course of our October committee meeting. And I'll ask if anybody has or wants to remove any of these particular items, that being 1 through 3, off the agenda.
Mr. Chair, since number 3 did not go through committee.
Oh, it did not? I thought it did. Well, I don't have my little...
Let's keep 1 and 2 on the consent agenda allow us to present.
To put the extra
I believe that's
in the wrong place. All right, and I'm going to change what I just said to two items, FB1 and FB2. Anybody want to remove those? In that, I will now entertain a hearing nothing. I will entertain a motion to approve action items FB1 and FB2.
Can I have a discussion on FB1?
Sure, if you want to. Let me ask you this, David. Do you mind if we just go ahead and vote on FB2 and get a motion on that one?
Absolutely.
And then get that out of the way. So we're going to remove FB1 off of the consent agenda. And I'll now entertain a motion for FB2.
Moved.
Motion second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Okay, let's go back to FB1.
I have concerns related to, specifically related to policies surrounding personnel actions, and particularly around the presentation of them. And I would appreciate at some future point if the board would look at revising some of the personnel action procedures. On behalf of, I'm speaking on behalf of the staff council and also in the best interest of the university, I'd like that at some future point to be looked at in the way that those are presented. Mm-hmm. I plan on voting in favor of FB1, but I want to make sure that there has been some confusion to me in my new role as to how some of these justifications are displayed. I would just like at some future point for that to be considered.
Fair request. Anybody else? All right, I'll entertain a motion then for the approval of action item FB number 1.
So moved.
Yep. Motion?
Second.
Second. Any further discussion or comment? Hearing none, all in favor of FB 1, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion carries. And we're now to FB 3. And I think the appropriate procedure is to ask for a motion for approval of FB 3.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yes.
So what we just approved?
No. Go ahead.
What we just approved, 1 and 2.
Just 1 and 2?
Yeah.
But will there be a note in the minutes regarding David's comment?
Action item follow-up.
Yeah. It'll be noted in the minutes.
Okay. I just want to make sure that...
That's a good point, Joy. And then, I'll see to it that I'll get with David and, just make sure those minutes tickle my process. Thank you. Go back to where we were. Do we have a motion for approval of FB3?
So moved.
A second. Now, Ian.
Thank you. All right, today I'll turn this over to Brad Shelley. I believe you've probably met him in previous times, but he's managing director with Crow, and Crow is our external auditor. So get ready for your continuing education units and your full understanding of governmental accounting standards. And Brad will do a great job walking you through our clean audit. Brad?
Thank you.
I should note that I think everybody should have a copy of the report. Anybody does it? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
All right, thank you. I don't think this will be quite as interesting as the last presentation, but we'll try to keep you awake. So thanks for allowing me to be here. My name is Brad Shelley. As Andy mentioned, I work with Pro. We have been the external auditors for a number of years, and I've worked with the university for probably the past 4 or 5 years now. So you have a number of documents in front of you. The largest one is the annual and financial statements. So to jump into that, I want to point out a few things. We won't obviously go through all of it, but point out some of the highlights. So starting on page 1 and going on until page 2, we have the independent auditor's report. So that is our report to you. This is the Board of Regents in outlining management's responsibility for the financial statements and then our responsibility to provide an opinion on those financial statements. So on page 2 of the financials, we're going to include the opinion. As Anne mentioned, it is a clean audit opinion and a modified audit opinion. So no concerns there. You'll see there is one separate section there called emphasis of matter. So that is just anytime there's anything additional in a current year. And this year there was the implementation of a new GASB statement number 75, which relates to OPEB benefits. So these are the other than pension benefits, employee benefits. And a new standard that required those to be recorded a little bit differently. And so you have a larger liability on the books. This is very similar to about 3 years ago with the pension side of things and where you had to record a net pension liability for that. You're now recording a net OPEB liability for these benefits as well. we'll look into that a little bit more as you can see the financial impact of that. Jumping ahead to page 14 and 15 are the start of the basic financial statements. Look ahead. This is the statements of net position. You'll see these financial statements are comparative, so they are for the years ending June 30, 2018 and 2007. As you look on page 14, this gives you your assets and deferred outflows of resources. Your assets are there in the middle, about $593 million at the end of the year, so just pretty consistent with the prior year, $598 million, slight decrease. On page 15, have these liabilities, deferred inflows of resources, and net position. You'll see some bigger changes here, and so especially focus on the non-current liabilities section, which is in the middle of the page. The first item I point out there is your net pension liability for the KTRS plan. See that decreased from about $373 million down to about $207 million. Part of how this the GASB is requiring you to record these liabilities now is you are subject to some fluctuations. It could be on an annual basis because of discount rate changes, other assumptions. There's a lot of assumptions that are built into this liability that is calculated by an actuary. In the current year, the Commonwealth of Kentucky contributed a much larger amount to the KTRS plan than they had in previous years. And the way that has an impact is that your share of that liability now has decreased significantly because the liability is based on the annual contributions to the plan. So you contributed less in comparison because the Commonwealth contributed a lot more. What we think will probably happen is then later on, when the Commonwealth goes back to a normal amount of contribution or contributes less, is this liability will go back up. So this is sort of a temporary change, if you will. The other side of that is actually somewhat reflected in the section below, deferred inflows of resources. You'll see that number actually went up a lot from about $11 million up to $113 million. So it's a lot of number moving around. What I would say in general is your liability hasn't really changed that much. Over the course of, you know, the next several years, when these payments will be paid out, I wouldn't expect that to really change much from what was last year. This is more of what I consider a temporary change. It doesn't really impact your income statement too much. It's mostly just here on the balance sheet that you see. But I didn't want to point that out because it's a large fluctuation in a couple of accounts. The other item of note here on page 15 is you'll see, again, in those non-current liabilities, there are two lines there called net OPEB liability, one for the KERS plan and one for the KTRS plan. That's what I was referring to earlier for the additional. This is primarily insurance, health insurance benefits for folks after retirement age. And so you're now recognizing that liability on here, about $61 million versus the previous year you did not have that liability. So that is the couple of changes that you'll see here on this these couple of pages. Any questions on any of that? I know that's a lot of technical accounting jargon, but happy to answer any questions.
I have a couple of questions, and this is not in its business, and so I have spent considerable time with this document, and I was actually trying to see are we actually well off or not. And so I understand that a lot of these numbers have to be there because the law requires them to be there, but my suggestion would be that maybe we can have some sort of pages which sort of separate some things out and allow actually us as a board to have a better feeling about the fiduciary responsibility we have towards this institution. And so I want to point out a few things here which sort of struck me. So this is on page 4. Okay. You see numbers about the total enrollment. And The way it sort of strikes me is you look at these numbers and you say, well, that's a slight increase, we're all good. Okay. And then when we go to page 19, okay, and we see our total operating revenues, then we see that they actually have declined. And if you would look at the current budget year which we're currently in, the RAP model estimates it to be about $190 million. So we've got a $10 million decline despite a, over these years combined, more than 10% increase in tuition. And so that indicates to me that when you look at the student enrollment numbers, that there must have been some substantial shift in terms of what kind of students are actually involved. And I think it would be very helpful if this would be broken out in some way which actually allows us to get a feeling for how we're doing. And obviously, if you were going to just think about it, if we would go with, as we reported, our revenue in 2017 would be $200 million and 10% increase should put us at $220 million, but we're looking at $190 million. And so that is a substantial drop in revenue, which indicates our student population has changed substantially.
Yeah, I guess the couple comments I would make is, I mean, I would agree, you could put in, you know, in the, we kind of skipped over a little bit the management's discussion analysis section that's starting on page 3, is a place where, you know, you can put in pretty much any information you would like to include in there, whether it's from the board, president, from the finance side. Any of that information can be put in there, so we're, you know, we're happy to work with management and put in any additional information that you think help clarify the financial position of the university. I think, obviously, like you said, there's a number of factors that go into that decrease. Some of it can be related to scholarships, tuition discounts, different things that maybe factor in because of the page 19, that revenue is discounted. That's just the, that's net of discounts and allowances. So you can see the increase in discounts and allowances went from 63.7 up to about 66.7. So that's about $3 million of the change right there. You had more discounts and allowances that went into that. But I think, you know, that's a good point. The financial statements themselves, the basic financial statements, do not always tell the picture, the accurate picture, or maybe the picture that you would like to portray. And so that can be, some of that can be added in here through this highlight section in the management's discussion analysis. The other thing I would say is, you know, as you look at page 19, and we hadn't really got there yet, you know, while your revenues did go down, you'll see the expenses also decreased by an even more significant amount, $41 million decrease. And so when you go to all the way to the bottom of page 19, and you get to your gain or loss before other capital contributions, which is really your net income, you know, before you deal with the capital types of costs, you end up at a positive $1.9 million this year versus a negative $39 million last year. So when you look at, you know, from a financial health standpoint, that's a much better year than the prior year, no matter how you dice that. Now, there was probably some challenges along the way. Anytime you have to, you have such a large decrease in expenses, obviously there's some challenges that go along with that. But that that does show that the financial health is improving in this year at least.
Just, you know, the cost brings up, I think, the right point, and it's something we as a board need to think about. Yeah, this is, no due respect, typical audit report. Okay, and you just go, you read it, the numbers, it does match up. When I reviewed it, I looked at the bottom. That's usually where I start, at the bottom. And so I'm saying we're in a positive position, but I think his point is, what is the right information for us as a board to understand from these numbers? And if we probably, even whether it's the finance committee, someone giving us guidance or general discussion about what do we think is important. Because what jumps out at this is that I know we've had general conversations about the makeup of the student population. And most of us would say that the change in tuition
is based on the change of international students who may have paid more. And but as a board, we should understand that so that we recognize as we're talking about student experience, we're talking about student cost and things of that nature, where this is all playing out. So I don't know the right answer, but I think the question's right that we should be thinking about, in addition to traditional information you find in an audit report, which is important to tell about the health of the institution, that we also say, what is important management information for us as a board to feel comfortable that we have our hands around what we think of the issues, and then we can have a conversation with the president and say, okay, what's the strategy and the plan? And I think everybody will feel better about where we're going as in terms of our oversight and the leadership that we have. But that's, you know, but I think he raises really a good point about us trying to understand beyond just the numbers, but the issues.
Well, would you like to say something? I've got a comment I want to make to that. I agree with Klaus. I mean, I think you look at the numbers, whether it's $39 million to the negative or $2 million to the positive, your function and role is to tell us what that is, not how we got there. We're the ones that need to make, well, why is it $39 million? Why is it $1.2 million? And that's where it comes from. Now, whether it's up front in the management response, which is probably from your perspective where it should be, nevertheless, your audit ought to tell us, oh, no, we better start thinking about something here. So I agree with both of
you. And if I could concur both with Regent Ernst and Regent Nichols. This is, again, part of our shift toward a net tuition revenue perspective versus a headcount perspective, that what is most important is what is the net revenue we're generating as an institution based upon enrollment and all the other pieces. And thinking about scholarship as discount instead of scholarship as expenditure, which is, again, a different way of thinking about how you discount the tuition. At the end of the day, are you doing it in such a way that increases persistence in enrollment, which also increases revenue? And I want to absolutely agree. And this is part of our evolution as an institution and having a conversation around what are the drivers for our decision making. And the driver is should not be necessarily headcount. That's an important thing to pay attention to. But how do we make strategic decisions that are designed to grow revenue and enrollment with the end result being a focus on student success, persistence, and graduation?
I would agree. And I think these are, you know, I don't take offense. These are very much more of a compliance nature type of thing. So this is more of looking to make sure that all the accounting and the controls you have in place are actually in place and are functioning properly. And as mentioned by Dr. Ernst, these are very much standardized in the way it has to be formatted, the way it's presented, and the rules you have to follow. So it's not uncommon to have, you know, another version of financial reporting that maybe has information that is more useful for operating decisions than these GAAP financial statements. But, you know, to the extent you want to include some things in here, those types of numbers or data, you know, we can certainly include that in that first section. The only other thing that I think I'll point out here in these financial statements, you know, this does include the component units as well. This includes WKU Foundation, their information in here as well. Student Life Foundation, College Heights Foundation are all included in this financial statement. On page 30 starts the notes to the financial statements, which just gives more information on a lot of the balances and transactions that took place. These are accounting policies. The only thing that I wanted to really mention here is on page 49 starts note 9 to the financial statements. And this is essentially, or sorry, 48 starts note 9. This is essentially a never-ending footnote. It's about 23 pages long now. This footnote has increased in size. There is a lot of additional information this year related to that net OPEB liability and the implementation of GASB 75. So if you want something to help you fall asleep, you can read through this. It has a lot of the assumptions and information about not only the pension plan, but also your OPEB benefits as well. But again, so that's just, there's added information if you were to compare with the prior year. The report's just getting thicker and thicker. That covers most of the significant items, I think, in these financial statements. There are a few other reports I want to just quickly go through.
Before you first, go, anyone else have any questions? One more question.
Yeah.
So, looking at this as an outsider, not somebody who knows how to set the government, I see that you sort of casually say, oh yeah, that's increased by 100 million, that's decreased by whatever, you know, because of the pension liability. And so if you were going to say, okay, that's if I, as a naive person, wanted to see what is the financial health of this institution, and I want to sort of look at this, what is the right number to look at? So, for example, if I look at the net position, which you have summarized there, then the total net position has decreased by millions, which is, of course, because of these extra liabilities we carry. And so that's not the right number to look at. I understand that.
Right.
But what is the right number to look at?
There's a number of factors. And again, these are not always the best tool for looking at financial health. There's a number of things. You know, you can look at your assets, because generally these pension and OPEB activities don't really impact your assets. So that's one area that you can look at and see, you know, are those increasing, decreasing, and then what do we have going on that would impact that? So if you are in a period where you don't have as much capital activity, you know, naturally your assets are going to decrease because they're depreciating over time, versus if you're in a capital intensive period, your assets are going to increase. So there's, you know, that's an area where you can kind of look at. You can also, I wouldn't discard all the liabilities. There are certain liabilities in here that are probably more important than others. When it's the pension and OPEB are the ones that are important. I mean, you're going to have to pay out a significant amount of money in benefits, but it's over a number of years and it's going on into the future until, you know, either you change the plans that you're in, or it just continues on until the, you know, university would ever end, essentially. So those liabilities are not something that you necessarily have to have a great concern about right now. If you were looking at the things I would look at on your, what I'll call the income statement or statements of revenues and expenses, again, is looking at the tuition revenue, looking at all your revenues. I would look more at the operating side of things, so your operating revenues and your operating expenses, and looking at those. And so that is always going to leave you at a negative if you just look at that operating line, because that's before you have your state appropriations and other kind of grants that are coming in. But I think that is also a factor. So I think really if you look at page 19, for the financial statements that we're presenting, that's probably the best source of information that you can look at. And I think looking and seeing tuition revenue is going down is an important question to ask about. And there's maybe reasons why, though. And so the same thing looking at your expenses. Decreasing expenses generally are good. It's not always good. There may be times where it's not a benefit to be having decreased expenses. So it's, I think it's really digging in more into each of these lines on the income statement, understanding, okay, why are things going up or down? I would definitely say when you go from the negative 39 million to the positive 2, that's a pretty good sign of increased financial health, but you still want to dig into some get into more information.
Thank you.
The other couple reports, a few reports I'll mention here quite quickly so we can move ahead, is there's also a single audit report, which I believe is a separate packet. There's a couple of different reports in here. One is the independent auditor's report, in compliance with government auditing standards, and that is two pages. again, looking at internal controls and compliance as it relates to financial statements and in accordance with the government auditing standards. And then you also have the internal auditor's report of compliance with uniform guidance, which relates specifically to your federal grants and that funding that you receive there. And again, providing an opinion on both compliance and internal controls. And so on both of those, you had no issues of compliance, non-compliance, no findings to report. That report also includes a schedule of expenditures of federal grants, which really just details out all the federal grants that you get. And so one of the biggest things to take away from this is just the volume of federal grants that you receive and the amount of activity that the, you know, the grants department is dealing with and that flows through not only for your student financial aid, but that's the biggest dollar amount, but you have a lot of other R&D and other types of grants that flow through here. So there's a lot of information here. In the current year, you had about $127 million of federal funds that were flowing through. So a lot of activity there. And then each year, as part of the audit, we are testing certain of those programs, certain programs within there. Every year is the student financial aid. Obviously, it's the most significant program that you have. So we test that. Then we also rotate in some of the other programs depending on the amount of expenditures and some other risk requirements. So this year we tested the student financial aid. We also tested the Head Start program and did not have any findings or issues with any of those programs. So a very, again, clean audit. That was something positive to report. There are three other letters. These are smaller. One is what we call the lease law letter, which is just looking at some of the Commonwealth of Kentucky lease law requirements and compliance with those. And this is we did not notice any issues or find any issues during our testing as it relates to those. Those are typically strictly related to new leases that we have in place. There's another one for Kentucky House Bill 622. This, again, is just an annual report in compliance with those requirements. Nothing there. And then the last one is actually addressed to the Finance and Budget Committee, what we refer to as Audit Communications Letter. It just goes through, again, our responsibility as auditors, different responsibilities we have. It lists out some of the significant accounting estimates, and then also would include in here any adjustments that were presented or proposed to management and may change adjustments, and there were not. So no audit adjustments, no past or waived audit adjustments. This also includes some other, what I'll call it, miscellaneous information, disagreements with management, significant difficulties. If we had any of those would be disclosed in here, and we did not have. So again, very clean audit process, smooth for the most part. We had a little bit of a hiccup with the KTRS reporting and getting some information from them, but that wasn't anything to do with the university. That was just getting information that we needed for that OPEB information. So that concludes everything that I had to report on. Again, open to any other questions anyone has or comments.
Anybody have any other questions? Anybody have any comments? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I think we have a motion on the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none, then all in favor of B3. I signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, like sign. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'd like to reiterate what George and Klaus said. You know, this document is a snapshot in time, and it should be intended to, and our responsibility to ask one question, and that is why. And not necessarily an easy question to answer, but why. Okay, so we're on information items, Mr. Andrew Laws is here with us today to talk about the new budget model, and sort of turn it over to you, Tony, if you don't mind.
Thank you very much.
I mentioned in the introductions.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity just to kind of set the stage. Those of you who have been following along in the public know that we've been thinking about how do we create a management tool that allows us to better understand our institutional budgeting process. And some portion of that is around including a broader group of individuals in that conversation. But the other piece to it is having a more transparent and actually more useful division of our income and expenditures. And from the day I arrived here, I began asking questions about how much revenue and what types of revenue do we generate, broken down by academic unit and or other revenue generating units, and how does that line up with expenses? And then perhaps more importantly as a management tool, what happens to those over time? And a year and a half ago, we could not answer those questions because we weren't seeing the world through a different lens. The new budget model process that we have helps us see that. And so this is a management tool for leadership, but in particular is a management tool for our deans as they begin to manage their colleges and think about the enrollment mix, the programmatic mix, and the expenditure mix, how they manage their subunits of the institution as we devolve additional involvement to that level of the organization. And so I'm just thankful that for the campus-wide participation in this process, folks like to throw the transparency word around. I don't know how you can be much more transparent than having fiscal year actuals 17-18 and projections for 19 online, the entirety of the spreadsheets that we put up just several weeks ago. And so this is an iterative process. The models have become more fine-tuned over time, but I think we're at a place where as people become more educated, they're also going to have a better understanding of how dollars flow across the institution. So with that, I'll turn it over.
Great. Thank you. So I'm Andrew Laws with Huron. I've met with all of you, I believe, twice now, but the last one was back in August. And I'm grateful that Brad just went through the audit because I'm not as much fun as the architects, but I'm more fun than the CPAs. So where we are again, we started this process in January. We followed a five-phase approach that focused on visioning the financial modeling, stakeholder engagement, and infrastructure development. So we've just now finished the infrastructure development kind of component of that, which puts us about 6-7 months away from the start of the new fiscal year and the real utilization of the model. Throughout this period, it says 75 stakeholders up there. I think we had about 75 meetings, but many of them had many, many stakeholders in them, so we touched a great number of roles around campus. Since we met with all of you in August, we've done a number of things, primarily focused on continuing to build engagement around campus, again, building out that infrastructure of what makes this model successful, and then three, transitioning really the ownership and management of this process from kind of your consulting team and the steering committee to Western Kentucky so you can move forward and be successful. Specifically, the things that we've done, so we have updated the president's cabinet, we've met with the faculty senate, we did kind of dog and pony shows with all the auxiliary and administrative support teams where we went and met with groups of 10 to 20 folks in each area and answered questions and walked them through the models. We had three steering committee meetings. We had, we've done this before, but we had a second round of department chair meetings where we went to every college and school and invited the department chairs to come and hear the update of the model and ask questions about that. We have developed a governance structure to oversee the model. We have built out the both high-level and detailed process that will facilitate decision-making under the new model. We have identified, I believe, six people, half in the provost office and half in the budget and finance office, that we have trained on all aspects of the model so, again, the university can own and manage this going forward. We have held a second open forum. You may recall earlier we had an open forum. We kind of did the opposite of the architects. They went and did this safari. We talked to other institutions and brought the other institutions here. So we brought a provost, a dean, a CFO from other institutions that have been through this, and had them come and talk to campus about what they experienced at their institutions. So we had a second open forum where we answered questions for faculty, staff, et cetera. And then we've charged the governance committee. So we've identified the membership and had kickoff meetings for those groups. And so a lot of activities over that 3 or 4 month period. So as President Camone mentioned, we now have 3 models in place. So 2 of those are based on actual fiscal year data, and 1 of them is based on the forecasts that are budgeted fiscal year. These models show, and one, I believe, very transparent sheet, where our revenues come from, which portfolio units or what operating units across the campus they're attributed to, how those different units have to expend those resources in order to accomplish their mission, and then what units are the net consumers and net contributors of resources. I will say, to the point of transparency, the columns up here show each college and school, and then there's colleges for other areas, administrative support units, auxiliary units, etc. Many universities just show, in a transparent nature, the colleges and schools. The executive team here has decided to be transparent to all of those numbers, and so we've posted all of this on the website, which is a material difference than what we see as one of the universities, but is very much helping with the engagement of all the team members, or all the stakeholders. As we think about kind of what the model tells us, so of course the model is not going to spit out any answers or tell us what to do differently. It's simply a tool, right? It's a tool that should help us facilitate our strategic plan. And ultimately, you know, the model tells us that we need to continue making difficult decisions, right? We know that our revenue has not grown the way we want it to, and we've had to make cost cuts as a reflection of that. When we look across the different colleges, we had, over the trend period, we had 1 college that saw revenues increase and their expenditures decline. From a fiscal perspective, that's terrific, right? That's what we need them to do in order to facilitate sustainability. Now, you could argue that maybe that's not great from a mission perspective, because as a mission-driven organization, we want all of our mission areas to grow each year. But fiscally, 1 college was performing extremely well. We had 1 college that saw both revenues and expenditures increase, but the revenues grew faster than expenditures. And so they're moving in the right direction, investing in their mission, but perhaps doing it in a slightly unsustainable way because they're making investments and hope that would come next. We had 2 colleges that saw both revenues decline and expenditures decline. Unfortunately, both of those, the revenues declined faster than expenditures. So again, unsustainable. But at least both of those are moving in the right, in the same direction. And then we had 1 college that was the worst performing that had revenues decline and expenditures grow. And so I give you those examples to illustrate that this is a different type of analysis, a different type of perspective, a different way for us to think about how we're managing and growing and investing in the colleges than what we were able to do 8 months ago, 12 months ago, a year ago, et cetera. So we're able to think about those impacts in a different way and have different types of conversations with the deans about what we need to do to put their colleges on a path where they're all supporting the strategic plan and moving in a sustainable direction. From a central university perspective, in this allocation model, what we do is we collect a portion of the revenues back from the colleges and use those as central resources. And so we use those central resources for 2 things. 1 is to get all the colleges back to a break even. And 2 is to invest in strategic plans. We did see that the portion of those central resources that would have to go back to the colleges to break them even increased by about 26%. So that's bad. When you think about, you know, where we're moving and what are the overall trends, what we want to see is that each year, a larger and larger portion of those central resources are available to be allocated towards strategic initiatives, not towards simply breaking even our past decisions. And so,
can I ask a question right there? So I see that you spit out a percentage there. What I'm wondering is the following. I've looked at some of these sheets, and the amount which Central was taken away has increased drastically over this time period, right, for various reasons. But then to say that basically if you tax colleges a higher rate during that period, and then you say, well, they need to be subvented at a higher rate, well, that's sort of... logically, from the higher taxation rate, that it has to happen this way. And so I think that I'm not sure your point three here is actually conveying a correct percentage or actually a correct statement in the first place. I don't have the numbers here, so I can't really rebuttal this, but it seems to me a strange way of looking at it.
So we've had several meetings with Klaus to go through some of the numbers, and so let me just step back a second to make sure we're all talking about the same things. And so I think the point he's making is that we do take in this model all the administrative and service costs, so HR, IT, facilities, et cetera, and we allocate them out to the colleges and ask them to be responsible for those costs that they consume. And I think the point that's being made is that those costs have grown. They grow, they're going to continue to grow. And they grow primarily because the two biggest drivers of them are salaries and benefits. And we give salary increases to our administrative and service teams, and we've seen their benefit costs go up. The challenge is that we need our revenues, of course, to grow faster than those costs go up. And so when those costs go up and we allocate them out, the delta that each college and school has is larger. And so when we have to match that delta, we have less money, or when we have to cover that delta, we have less money for strategic initiatives. That's the point I'm trying to make. I think what you would say is that we need to make sure we're managing those cost increases the right way so the delta is lower, not because of the lack of revenue growth, but it's lower because we're managing our administrative service costs appropriately.
That's part of it, but I think like in the 19 year, there have been relatively large sums of money accrued in Central to cover a variety of costs like pension things and the salary raise. So this distorts the picture somewhat. And my understanding is, you tell me if I'm wrong, that the percentage which Central sort of takes out, has that not increased as a percentage over that time span?
It has increased as a percentage because the revenue has gone down. Our pie has gotten smaller.
So absolute as well. Can I swear to it? Because I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Yeah, I'm not sure. In general, what we want to see in this model, and one of the benefits of the transparency that you have in the model, is that, you know, when we get asked questions by a faculty senate or someone like that, you know, how much do we spend on administration, how much do we spend on academics, et cetera, you have to be a CPA, like the last gentleman here, to really understand those costs in our audit, right? But this now shows it in one page. We can see very clearly, you can't see it on this, but if you go to the website and click on the model that pops up, you can see very clearly the number right here is what we spend on academic units, and the number here is what we spend on administrative and support units. So right now we've got a three-year trend period, so you can see all three of those, and you can see how that pie slice changes from year to year. So in addition to rolling out some of these models, we have redesigned the governance structure that will help facilitate decision making in this process. So nothing has changed about the top of the governance structure. Of course, this board still retains all budgetary authority, retains the approval for all the budgets. President Caboni still retains the ultimate authority to bring a proposed budget to this board. What has changed is the way that we're engaging the stakeholders to put that budget together. And so, in particular, there's two new committees. There's an executive budget committee and a support unit allocation committee. The executive budget committee is meant to be our broad-based representative committee that is ensuring that we're bringing university perspectives and priorities into account and that we're putting together a budget that ties to and aligns with our strategic plan. They will help measure things like how we're using our central support dollars and how those are being used to manage the consumption or contribution of resources for colleges. The other committee, the Support Unit Allocation Committee, you can think of as more of the stakeholder committee. This is primarily made up of college and school deans, because when we ask the deans in this new model to pay for cost, to pay for space, to pay for IT, to pay for HR, etc., we want them to have legitimate and strong role in that decision-making process and determining what service levels we want to set those services at and therefore what costs are we willing to spend on those services to match those service levels. And so both of these committees we have charged and kicked off a couple of weeks ago, and they are now beginning to, they've elected chairs and they're beginning to identify their meeting calendar and start facilitating this process. Now, I'll tell you that we advise the committee that this is a crawl, walk, run kind of process. It's all not going to be figured out in the next 7 months. You can see at other universities that this is a 2 to 4 year process to get them to the point where they really have good comfort in their arms around all these different decisions, but we have begun that process.
So I don't have a question, but I want to point something out. Please. When we went through the budget process last time, George, you made a comment. And the comment, and I remember it very well, I hope I do, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that before we were in the dark, and now we start to move out into the light, and the slow process, something like that, right? A lot of times we miss this, but this is exactly what we're referring to. It has to engage not only this board and the president, it has to engage every part of the university. And I want to point out that this is exactly what we're talking about, become more engaged in this. But we may not like the numbers that we see, and we may all disagree on certain aspects of expenditures, etc. But this is the process that has been begun by President Boney and enhanced. Comment that you made, George, and I think this is a good point to stop and say, this is what we were talking about. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Andrew, but I want to make a comment, because we sometimes lose sight of that.
I think that's great. And the provost used a very similar phrase at the open forum of faculty, and she said, we're going from the dark to the very bright light, and it was blinding us right now. We needed to just give it time to let our eyes adjust. But this does give us new data points and perspective. Right? So we, through this model, the way we're allocating this now, we know that we're spending $28 per square foot in our space. So if a dean wants to have more research space or more classroom space, he or she needs to be willing to spend that amount of money to get it. We know that we're spending $310 a head on IT. We know that we're spending $830 per student FTE on academic and student services. Those become metrics that we now can track and measure year over year, and we can think about, does that match our strategy? Does that make sense? Are we allocating our resources the right way? We didn't have those types of easy metrics before, or it would have taken you 6 weeks to get them, right? And now you just automatically get them every time the model is updated, and we've got these committees in place that are designed to monitor, measure, track, and weigh in on those types of things.
Active participation.
Are we benchmarking those type of costs against other institutions to see where we stand?
In some cases, it makes a lot of sense to benchmark. In some cases, it doesn't. And that, in my view, that goes back to the crawl, walk, run type of perspective. So we've told the committee that the best practice would be to do some of that benchmarking. And it's pretty easy to get benchmarking data in IT, HR, facilities. When you're thinking about like academic program or academic support, the provost office, it's very hard to come up with a benchmark because what's included in that number is different from institution to institution. So we've done some spot checks and we'll continue to do that, but that's one of the charges of the committee is to think about how detailed they want to do that benchmarking and where they, which units they want to start with for that benchmark.
Oh, I'm sorry, David.
I apologize. I'll tell you, as you know, I had the opportunity to attend one of the open forums. I asked some very direct questions. Some of them were due to my own lingering levels of lack of education on the process. Not only was I satisfied with the approach to the answers, I really need to commend the provost and CFO for addressing several of those concerns that same day. There was direct follow-up, and I will tell you all that some of the questions that were asked resulted in the addition of an additional staff member to the space allocation committee. There's an effort to engage and train business office-related individuals as a result of some of those discussions. So little tiny things that we, you know, kind of were able to dive into. And I also got an extra, I commend Ann Mead for a personal extra hour with the president this week to go over any lingering concerns or presentation on this. You know, everything that I asked and every concern that I had related to the staff was answered. I appreciate your time and the effort on this. I've seen this presentation and variants of it now three times, and each time it's evolved. It was an engaging session. I appreciate it.
Sure. It's really a follow-up on what David just said. When you go through change, the first thing you have to start with is trust. Forget about everything else. Just start with trust. And regardless of where people may think we are, what people may think of past leadership, existing leadership, whatever it is, trust is built by exposing information. You may not like what you see, but it's there. And the thing that I've been impressed with is that effort to say, look, we're trying to move to another place. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be new. It's a change. So what we're going to do is everybody has the same set of information. And that's what we're going to use as the basis for us now to be educated, engaged, and lead to a better place. And so David is basically saying that it's working. It's not going to be fun. It's not enjoyable, I'm sure. Tim and Casey have had, she probably had to deal with more of his lack of fun. But that's really the most important thing. And I hope that we continue as an institution of that. How you build trust is that transparency, the information's there. If there are mistakes, and there will be mistakes, that we address those, we correct those, so that we can all get on the same page, then I think we can get to the place that we want to be. But this to me is much, when you think of change management, much broader than the process and actually what you're trying to do is, we're talking about human beings believing and trusting each other, that what we're trying to do is in the best interest of Western Kentucky University and its students, and that we're going to be in a better place at the end of the day. And okay. So I'm glad to hear David say that's happening.
And it's worth noting, so of course, Ann and Terry deserve a great deal of credit. We've had a steering committee that deserves a lot of credit, too. They have met 10 or 12 times over the last month, over the last year, and gone through a lot of hard slots to get us here today. A number of them are in the room here today. And just thanks for all that.
Gosh. I don't want to always sound negative, so I have to clearly say that I'm in favor of this model as well. And I think that it does bring more transparency than we've ever had about budgeting process on this campus. And so I'm very much in favor of it. Andrew, I wanted you to address a little bit. So if I look at the 19 sheet, the thing which sort of still isn't quite there's no incentive fund. And I see it's very, very difficult that in a declining budget structure, such an incentive fund, it's very difficult to create, but without it, the whole advantages of this SMAC model go away because you've got to reward units which show initiative and are successful with it. And so how do you envision that this would have worked?
So what I would say is that any implementation like this is better when financials and resources and revenues are improving and moving up. All over harder when times are tough, right? And unfortunately, that's the position we're in, is that times are tough. Now, we feel like this is a tool that will help us turn that dial. Okay? Now, in terms of incentives, the way this model works is that it recognizes activity levels, and it funds colleges and schools based on those activity levels. And so, for example, for every college or every undergraduate credit hour that a college teaches, they get $297. For every credit hour that one of the college's students take, they get 106 credit hours. And so when we look at those examples that I gave earlier, the colleges that were going up and down, et cetera, Ed saw revenue, education saw revenues go up over this term period because their credit hours went up, right? Now, in this model, or in a legacy model, what would happen is when revenues decline, the colleges that saw revenues decline would come to the provost and the AN, and they would say, well, I know my revenues are down, but I was too tightly staffed before. Now I'm right-sized, and so I can't really take anything out of my budget. And the colleges that were growing would come and say, man, this growth has been pretty intense. I need more resources. And our hands would be tied. There would be no new money to make any allocations. And now with an activity-based model, we'll see those dollars go up and down. We still want to have central resources to provide flight plans and to allow colleges that are perhaps seeing a decline get out of that. But what the model does is it gives us the data to make better decisions. It gets more people into that decision-making framework. It provides the incentives for more people to engage in those activities, and so that's what's going to change. The model itself didn't create or destroy wealth or spit out any answers, but it better positions us to make those hard decisions.
Okay.
So I'm over time, I think, so I'm going to skip this other than to say that this is kind of roughly the process. It starts with planning assumptions, then it goes to the first committee, and we put together the assumptions for the administrative units. Then the academic units would make their budget proposals. Ultimately, the decisions are proposed, and they're brought to this group. I think what's more interesting is since we met with you in August, we've started to transition our conversations with various stakeholders and the deans away from how do we want to design the model and how the model can be a catalyst for moving forward and a catalyst for doing things differently. This gives a handful of examples. So, one, the model very clearly will help us think about new program development. And so as we think about kind of what is a break-even point for a new program? Can I launch a new program? And what will that generate for my college? How long will it take to generate revenues? This model now gives us data to make those assumptions and to make those decisions in a more informed way. We think about the entire academic portfolio. We're moving to a place where we can better understand which of our programs generate revenue and which of them consume our resources, such that we can make a balanced portfolio. And we can make those academic trade-off decisions. And, you know, we may know that it's pedagogically best to have 20 students in a classroom. But with this, we can make a decision to put 23 students in a classroom and know that there's going to be enough resources that flow back to our college to then hire a TA for that class. Would we rather have 23 with a TA or 20 without a TA? So what are the kind of decisions we want to make there, and how do we facilitate those trade-off discussions? This model has material incentives for research and research collaboration. So, of course, we want to be a student-centered applied research institution. And so how do we do that? How do we incentivize that? How do we get the deans and the chairs and the faculty aligned with that? This model takes some state appropriations, and for every dollar of funded research that a college does, it will attribute 85 cents of state appropriations to that college. It's a very strong incentive to go out and do that research. Space management, I gave the example earlier of the cost of space, but we can optimize space as a university if we manage it all centrally. At the same time, there are some good and appropriate reasons for colleges and schools to own their own space. So we want to be able to say that if a college emails the registrar and says, I need a lecture hall for 100 students next semester, and the registrar can email back and say, okay, you've got room 201 in building X, and it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 8 a.m., then they're not paying for that space because the registrar is determining where they're teaching. If they say, no, this is my you know, high maintenance, important professor, and he or she will only teach in the classroom next to their office, and it has to be on Tuesday, Thursday, 11 a.m., and this and that and the other, then they've got first right of refusal of that space, and they're going to be paying $38 a square foot to use that space. And so we want every dean to decide on their own how much space they want to pay for and how much space they're going to allow us to optimize as a university. And so those are how, this is an example of how some of these decisions change. The administrative service delivery, we, again, I talked about the committee that will set service levels and funding levels. We want to decide, are we willing to accept lower service levels and spend less, therefore have money available for our academic and mission-driven organizations? Or would we, do we want higher service levels and we're willing to pay for those? So this model facilitates those conversations in a different way. It also helps us think differently about where there should be, where we're willing to, where we want redundant administrative operations, right? Should we have distributed IT support out in the colleges and schools, or should all that be centralized? Things of that nature. So those decisions become much different. So there's a longer list of this, but these are just five of the ones that we thought were more tangible and we'd share with the reasons. In terms of next steps, so again, over the course of the last 6 months, 3 months, 1 month, we've been increasing the transition from the steering committee from here on to the management team, and so that will continue. So ownership is transitioning, the committees have been launched, the process has started, and we will continue to make updates and to engage stakeholders through the RAMP website, which has a lot of material on it. It has all the presentations that Huron has made in the steering committee. It's got FAQs, it's got timelines, it's got models, it's got video recordings of open forums. So again, it's an extremely transparent and data-rich website that, that we're asking people to use and leverage. That'll be the continuing path.
And just one comment on the model development process. We've made a lot of improvements on the lead time we have between when we get the budget and when we're approving the budget. This looks pretty tight with a lot of these decisions being made in May. And I just don't want to, I want to make sure we don't backslide on the amount of time we have to review.
So we're going to be doing a call for budgets in January of this year, but that process next year is going to be in October. So there is a squeeze for this year. It's going to take some more direct engagement, obviously, with the Finance Committee, and I've got Ann's commitment that we're going to make sure we go as quickly as we can while also sharing information as far in advance as we can.
Yeah, just as a best practice, where you've got to get to is you've got to get to where you have this in a 3-year forecast, and then every year just finalizing that 1 year is not a big surprise, right? So it can be done a lot more quickly with a lot more comfort, right? Because you have guidance into that 3-year plan. And that's your rolling kind of forecast. And then as you roll up into that, you know, March, April, May period, and the board is asked to approve the budgets, you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, what's different from our forecast? What has changed since we looked at this 7 months ago? And we just point out those changes. And so you end up being a much more informed board and you can make those kind of decisions in a stronger way without necessarily getting the document earlier.
Part of our discussion this morning, I think, is pertinent to this, in recognition of the difficulty of change and the fact that we're asking some people who before had not been asked to make some of the tough decisions to possibly look at incorporating some training sessions in here to help deans and department heads understand this new role that they're taking on, and I hope we can take a look at that and make that process smoother.
Sure, we can. I will take that back to the committee and make sure that we're appropriately planning for this.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Great. Again, I hope I was more interesting than the auditor.
uh,
That concludes finance and budget.
All right. We are going to take a 10-minute break, and we'll reconvene at 2:05.
Yeah, you did. I was coming over to say something.
I know. You didn't have to.
Well, look at it. Yes, we did it.
Okay, we will reconvene and go right into our Academic Affairs Committee. So, Regent McKinney.
Oh, yeah, I think I'm used to that at all.
All right.
Everything on the agenda for today is a consent agenda. So, and was approved in the committee meetings. Do I have a motion to know? Oh, does anybody want to move stuff? Oh, we do. I'm sorry. Not sure. All right, we're going to separate AA-1 out separately to, for approval. Do I have a motion to approve AA-1?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to have the privilege of moving to approve action item AA-1 for the naming of the Thompson-Kelly Thompson Complex Center Wing is the Kelly Thompson Hall. Kelly Thompson was a native of my hometown, Lebanon, Kentucky. Was very instrumental in many of our citizens gaining the opportunity for higher education and had a direct impact on my coming to Western and staying at Western. So it would be my honor to move and make that motion.
I'll second that motion.
Do I have any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. Would anybody like to remove any of the other AA-2 through 4 from the consent agenda? Hearing no. I'll take a motion to approve AA-2 through AA-4.
So moved.
Second.
All right, do we have any discussions or presentations for AA-2 through
4? No.
Okay. Does anybody have anything? All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passed. Okay, go ahead.
I like, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the faculty who have been wholeheartedly recommended for American status. And here we have, today we have Dr. Michael Ann Williams. Would you please stand? Dr. Williams is a distinguished university professor. She has excelled in teaching, research, and service over her 32-year tenure at WKU. The hallmark of her teaching was experiential learning as she engaged students through projects such as recording oral histories and creating museum exhibits. An internationally recognized scholar, Dr. Williams penned 3 books and authored numerous journal articles. She tallied hundreds of dollars in grants. Dr. Williams was instrumental in the creation of the Department of Folk Studies and served as the first head for 12 years. She received the Potter College Award for Public Service, and she was president of the American Folklore Society and vice president of the Vernacular Architecture Forum, and she served for decades on state boards and commissions. I'd also like to ask that Ms. Rosemary Mazaros, the professor of Library Public Services, stand. Thank you. Ms. Mazaros joined the faculty of Library Public Services in the spring of 1997 and was promoted to professor in 2011. She's a former academic librarian of the year in Kentucky and is this year's honoree as the ProQuest Godart Documents to the People Award, which is the profession's highest honor for government document librarians. Ms. Mazaros provided outstanding service as WKU's coordinator of government documents and law for the past 18 years. Congratulations. And the third faculty member is Dr. Charles H. Smith, who is not able to be with us today, a professor of library public services, who has enjoyed a distinguished career here at WKU since 1995.
I thank both of you all for being here. It's always great when we can see students or faculty and professors. Great of both of you all to be here. Okay. Other business, Regent Henson is here today to bring us forward with the bylaws discussion. She has worked extremely hard on this project, and I think this last week we got some information on it, and I'll turn it over to Regent Henson.
Just to let you all know who we are, Deborah, actually, I need to thank Deborah and Julia for helping with Julie McDonald and Deborah Wilkins for helping me work on this. Deborah put together and sent out to you all, or part of the packet that Julia sent to you, was a red line of the bylaws, which kind of showed you what the changes were, and then a clean version, which allowed you to see or be able to read it without kind of going with the yellow, the red, the different colors, those kind of things. Also on the red line version, if you all have reviewed it, you'll see the notations about changes and why they were made. And it appears when you review it that every one of those changes that you all asked back in August that be made to document were made. And my understanding is, Julia, you gotta help me. Julia and Deborah, can you call this a first reading or is this another? Okay, so.
Yes. Are you calling first reading?
I mean, if you want to present.
Well, that's where I kind of want to ask you, because I'm not really sure, because I didn't know if we need to take other people's comments or we need further discussion. But I just wanted you all to see this. We went through a pretty lengthy process to get it where it is. If you all have any questions, we can answer those now. We may need to do the reading. If we feel like it's kind of a right thing to do after we've had some discussion, that's probably how we ought to move forward. I also wanted to talk to you all about, we never did really officially decide whether we were going to have a bylaws and then a policy and procedure manual. We talked about it briefly. I think there were some concerns. And there was also, I believe it was brought up that we would be the only ones doing that. Well, I looked at all the other universities in the state of Kentucky, and they had a set of bylaws and a policy and procedure type document. It wasn't always called a policy and procedure document, but there was always two documents. The bylaws actually governed how the board was to run, and then the policy and procedure manual on how we got those things done. And so we never really decided that. So I know that Klaus was concerned about that because he was talking about wanting to put some spending limits and some, I don't want to say controls on the president because that's not really the appropriate word, but I can't really think of anything else to say, but I think you all understand what I'm trying to say. And Klaus, that was the second document. So when we're going to do this now, we'll look and approve the bylaws. So we'll discuss it. Then if we're ready for his first reading, we'll do that. We also have some samples of some documents for the policy and procedure sheets or documents we need. But I didn't really want to start passing those out because I didn't really want it to look like we were plagiarizing somebody else's university's document. So we've got samples of that. And so I thought the best way to handle this would be bylaws first, then we work on that other document. Does that sound okay with everybody? Now, does anybody have any comments or want to have a discussion on the changes?
I'd just like to commend Julie for work. It's a lot that went into this. And when I reviewed it, I thought it made sense. It was consistent. Commended for that. And also, the reference to the second document. I hope as we go through this process, we consider doing the second document because I think it makes sense for us to have a separate document that we can quickly manage and go through when we have to make adjustments depending on the circumstances. And it's really an attempt not to control the president, but to assist the president in doing things necessary. So I'm one of those who would be supportive of there's a separate policy document that we do that deals with spending limits and all that other stuff separate from the bylaws.
Mr. Chairman, you know, we've heard a lot of policy-related information today. I've had some policy concerns. Klaus, Regent Ernst, and Regent Nichols have brought these questions up as well. I've got a few related to personnel approval and presentation type reporting. You know, in the spirit of continuing the progress that the president and the provost have made so far with everybody else and the evolution of the university, would it be inappropriate to ask for a policy committee to be formed?
I don't think that'd be inappropriate at all. Like an ad hoc committee.
An ad hoc committee.
Policy. What others think?
I think so.
I'd be glad to appoint one. Good.
I do think it's good to have one document that governs the board and a separate document that kind of governs the responsibilities.
Do you think we need to vote on that? Or do you think just because we're having discussions, we realize there may be, there are two documents, so that's where everybody's looking. Freddie, were you the one that was a little bit concerned about that second document? Do you want to say anything? Because I know that was...
I think these things dovetail together. I have no problems with including or not including it or putting it in a separate document. I just think that we've got to empower the president somewhere, whether that's in the bylaws or in an attached,
right,
incorporated policy. And I would suggest that these things have to arrive simultaneous together. So otherwise, we've got a president with no authority.
Right. Montgomery, totally agree that they should they dovetail and complement. The thing is, though, that his ability to run the university and then our process of bylaws, we could be in trouble. And so it's really trying to say, let's give the direction and appropriate ability for him to carry out his job, but give it in a flexible way that he can be responsive to the things that happen, but it is consistent coming out of one of the bylaws. And that really was, to me, the big thing of having the two separate ones.
I'm looking at this and hearing these two comments. Something at least it's in my mind. A board, any board, board be it of a corporation or board of a university like this, has to identify that the directors or trustees or regents appoint an officer or officers. Right? So I think it's appropriate in the bylaws to say, okay, we're going to, you know, one of our functions is to vote up or down and hire a president. And you ought to say that, even though it's statutory. Right? The second thing is, you can say, he can have the following responsibilities. You can say he'll be responsible for developing a budget or whatever it may be, subject to the policies that are adopted from time to time by the board. And then the board can adopt a separate set of policies. That's my thought process, is that they need to have a second set of policies. But you can still say,
The thing is that if you said, like, he has a limit of $5 million, and there's a typical expense at $6 million. Have to go back to the Board of Regents for us to change the bylaws.
That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah. So I agree with what you're saying, is that it's referenced in here that there's a separate document that outlines more specific some of the things that he does on a day-to-day basis.
Correct, because I think Klaus made a good point at one point in time. You ought to have some limits in there, and the next board may decide that those limits are too low or too high, or circumstances may change. You don't want to have to go into this document and start making changes.
That makes sense.
But you can define what it brought responsibility.
And yeah, that makes sense to me, and I think it makes sense to you. It's just that, again, I just know that there are going to be things he's going to run into that we will not think about. And we're trying to give him the flexibility to be able to deal with those in an appropriate manner, because we have done our fiduciary responsibility, which was we hired the president. And we've said, now we've empowered you to go carry out your job.
Mr. Chair, if I could add my opinion as the person who will be subject to these policies, this is absolutely something that anyone in this seat will want, because it's not a restriction. It actually creates the opportunity for additional transparency and cover. So the last thing that I ever want to do, or anybody in the seat should ever want to do, is to make a decision that one's own board might question. And what a policy that says anything above a certain amount of dollars does, it says it's something that might be high risk or attract a great deal of attention. I don't want to be hanging out on my own making that decision. What I want is the cover, support, and backing of my board. And so I'm excited about that, and I think it's appropriate.
Klaus?
I would strongly argue that we should vote on the bylaws and the policy together. And the reason is that once we design a policy, we may actually insert certain sentences into the bylaws which says, this is governed by the policy section, blah.
Yeah,
and so I think that that's why these documents need to go intrinsically together. It should be passed on as a unit, not separately.
And I don't think there's any pressure to do it otherwise. I think
Could I ask a question?
What I'm hearing is people agreeing with that.
When you say what you just did, do you mean that if we have a policy on a given point, it still has the capability of being changed by a future board or somebody?
Of course.
Okay,
of course.
All they're still there are two separate documents.
Well, yes, but what he's saying is that right now that he was expecting a presentation, I believe, of both the bylaws and a policy. Getting the bylaws all set up, I found some good examples of a delegation of authority or whatever you want to call it that even Deborah said would be a good document to use as a blueprint to be able to do what we're trying to do. But there was a lot of question about that there wasn't transparency about the bylaws and some things like that, so we felt compelled to give you what we already had because a decision had not been really made whether we have two documents or not. So we were trying to, because of the questions that were being brought up by several of the board members, some grumblings that were going on, we wanted to go ahead and address it and say, okay, guys, here's some bylaws, and then we'll work on a document. It makes sense probably to have them both that way, but we were trying to please everybody and let you all know where we were. So if you want to pull this off the table, we get a committee, because there is already a structure that Deborah says is a good one for us to work for to do the policy and procedure. And then we work on that as a committee and bring it all forward. If you all would rather do it at the same time, that's fine. It's just that we were trying to stop the grumblings and let everybody know where we were. And that was kind of our solution, was to show you the bylaws, do a first reading, and go forward.
So I guess what I'd like to know is what procedurally, how would that work? So
I think they're
would we
conspiring.
We define it as a first reading. And then you can bring the other piece and then you put
it
together.
We need a first reading. Go ahead. I think if you do a first reading, then you can't change it at the second reading without having to do the whole process all over again.
I think it's got to all come together at the same time.
That's what I want to know.
And so what I'm hearing is you all are giving me permission to appoint another ad hoc committee to address this policy thing. And then that can come along with the bylaws committee. And hopefully it all comes together nicely at one time.
Okay.
So should we table it until the next meeting? I guess what I'm asking. So do we need to make a motion to table it?
Or you can just
wasn't presented for action today. This was literally just discussion and the opportunity for you all to weigh in on any other changes or revisions that you'd like to see. This wasn't presented as an action item today.
Do you all have any change? Like if you see something now, let's talk about this. So that we can incorporate that and then, like the other community come and bring, because I've got some stuff already, documentation for the next part of it, possibly.
Yeah, I do.
Yes, you can ask a question.
What would it take to approve a policy and procedure? Is it just an up or down?
Majority.
I guess,
majority.
Or whatever we end up saying.
Just like we do on
up or down policy.
But if you're going to package them together, they'll both go through the same process.
Sure. Okay. I think Article 7 here, we need to relook at that from the perspective of it's the board is employing a president, and you've got certain obligations, and they're pretty well delineated there. I mean,
Deborah,
providing leadership, et cetera.
I'm sorry, Deborah was the one who suggested that whole Article 7 be removed. Because she felt like it was in.
Yeah, I think we talked about putting that in the policies part.
Jill, are you talking about the old document or the new document?
No, no, no. talking about it. Well, I guess it's all one. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. One of the reasons why, I'm sorry, Deborah, I didn't let you finish. I think one of the reasons why I think I disagree with that, be persuaded otherwise, is that we have to have some sort of appointed authority within this document itself. So it says, we go out and we hire the president. We give him the broad areas of responsibility and obligation, whatever they are defined to be, and that's it. But it doesn't set, you know, so maybe you have control over the budget, but the policy sets the limits where you have the right to sign contracts, but the policy says you can't sign a contract more than $10. So I think those are two different things. And that's what I was alluding to just a moment ago.
Deborah, if I remember correctly, and I have notes, that was all removed because you felt like it was in violation of the statute of Kentucky.
I think we're talking about two different things.
Yeah, we are.
Okay. Number seven is the...
The old seven.
The red line.
The old
That's all that highlight that you marked out. I thought that that was because it was in violation or not compliant with the statute of Kentucky.
The first proposed revisions back under the previous president had proposed adding information within the violation section. It would have been board delegating authority to government the power to delegate to the board. So there's certain responsibilities the board has to fulfill. So I took that out. And then when we came back in August, there was a discussion, should what the information in there dealt with the president and what the president was empowered to do. And at that time, some of the members thought, that's really more of a presidential issue. It's not a board issue. If you look at the language, it's saying the president shall do this. The president shall do X or Y. So we took that out to put it in procedures. The short answer is we can put it back in there. The language that was in there originally, we can put it back in there very easily. Yeah, so there were some things that were wrong with the first proposed revisions. We took those out, but we can put the original language back in.
So, Seymour, keeping with what Gil said, is when we go through this new ad hoc group, which is going to address issues that the president would be doing that we're saying want to give flexibility to, then they should also work through what part of this, which would satisfy Gil's statement of there should be broad categories of this is what the president's role is supposed to be. Okay? And the rest of it is could be found in the policy procedure. Mm-hmm. And that way, because I don't know if all of this has to go in, but some of this may need to go in that addresses that need, and then the rest of it is referenced within the policy procedure.
That's precisely what I'm saying.
But I think this ad hoc group could make that determination because you're going to be thinking about the stuff that you want to give the flexibility to the president on, and then whatever's left, then you'll know goes back into the document.
Well, what was interesting when I understood Deborah to say that it was against statute, when you started looking at other Kentucky University documents, they had a very small description of what the president should be doing.
Right.
And then
right.
When we started marking this out, and when the lawyer of the university scratches all of it out, and my understanding was it was a statute issue, and there was nothing addressed for the president's, then I thought, oh my goodness. So that one of the reasons why, when you all asked me why I also got a third opinion or a bylaws expert to look at it, were some issues like that, because I wanted to make sure that we were in compliance as well. And they had some questions about this same that we should have some kind of information, just general, in the bylaws. So it is something that needs to kind of be looked at.
So general, but it does have to be clear.
It
references the policy and procedures, which is a separate document, so it all does go together.
Yeah, most of the bylaws, I see, corporate paragraphs.
Yeah, right, law.
That's right.
And then everything else is in the
document. Yeah, everything else is someplace.
But I really do think, Mr. Chair, if this committee could help us make that determination with Deborah's involvement on everything that goes in there, what's the general statement that would go in the bylaws that fits our responsibility as a Board of Regents and the rest of it. And then the reference.
Okay. I think I got it.
I think part of the problem is we're dealing with revisions that have that started before some of the current board members were appointed.
And yes.
Or later.
So we try to bring both these processes along. Hopefully they dovetail nicely. And we can possibly, at our next meeting, even have a first reading. But I think I'm also hearing Julie ask people for any comments or questions about what is here, so that in the meantime, and again, there have to be some communication and collaboration on these things coming together, but I think we have some more time for people to read what's here and then voice questions or have discussion about any points. We do have three attorneys on the board, and I'll be the first to admit when I start reading bylaws, I get a little glassy-eyed, but between our board attorney and...
I get that way when I do surgery.
So, is that a fair description of where we're heading?
And we might, honestly, Dr. Bale, look at getting an expert review of this as well. Because when you go through, I read enough books. I read four books. And if you ever have I'll let you have my books. Okay. So just so you have it there, but the Association of Governing Boards, when I talked to Carol Cartwright, she suggested I read these books and those kind of things. And she's one of the ladies that will be speaking at the 18th on the afternoon session. I think that Linda's going to be attending. She's great. And she suggested I get these books, and it talks about how hard it is to revise bylaws. And it says, revising bylaws is a highly specialized task that the board should entrust to an expert, not to its own members, even if some of them are lawyers. Well, I'm sorry, that made me laugh, because as soon as I saw that, I started thinking about our lawyers on this board. But I think that we probably need to have an expert look at it at some point in time when we get to the point, so that we get make sure that everything does feel like we'd like it to, and then it all comes together. Because we still have some questions on some things, too.
Comments?
I like Julie's comment about getting somebody to look at it, and necessarily if that becomes possible. I had a few just typo types of things, but I'd rather not get into those if we're going to do the review, because they'll all flesh out at that time.
Because Deborah did do the final update of everything.
It seems like we're wasting time today to get into that, but I don't want somebody to say, well, why didn't you say that such and such was not consistent with such and such?
Deborah, would it be best if he gave us, because actually Deborah's going to have to retype it. We're going to have a document retype, Freddie, because it's been all...
Just send me a text or an email and I'll...
Because Freddie, this has all been cut and paste. So we realized that some of that, too, was formatting some other issues. And there's a thought that once we get this done, it will be all typed and the little package. So they just start over from scratch instead of doing all this cut and pasting that's been taking place.
We're working on the old work. Y'all remember that?
Okay.
I have one more comment I want to make to the document as it exists. So there are certain standing committees of the board. And I think there ought to be a generic description if they're all dealt with the same way. So you have here a bunch of sentences which are repetitive. It says the committee shall consist of a minimum of X members. The president shall appoint blah, blah, blah. And that could all be sort of taken out. This applies to all the disstanding rules of the committee, and then it doesn't have to be repeated.
Well, we do that. And also, too, I believe it was suggested that the committee chairs talk to their
respective
administrators to get their input on whether the information was accurate or not, because some of it's a little bit outdated there as well. And that was caught in the last little bit as well. So those were things that was they were a suggestion. That's why when we kept getting these suggestions, since this document went out, whether we need to do a first read or not was part of it too. So know that there was some thought and some discussion after that you all went out and started getting feedback. So
in that vein, and I know we've already talked about it a little bit, but I've heard more about maybe we should all think of how do we want to do our committee meetings. Do we want to do them the way we have been, everybody together, or do we want to separate them out with a staff person? I think that's not something, obviously, we decide today, but I would ask people to think about that. And I know Linda brought that up to me recently. I think one or two others have said something in the past about that, and yeah, I'm not sure we couldn't even try something for quarterly meeting sometime and see how we like it, you know. I don't know if that has to be in the bylaws or we can just say, hey.
Well, my suggestion was to take the number of people out in the bylaws that had to be in a committee because of the way we do our committees now. Because really, it's not a separate committee. We're all in here together. We're all talking about it. So one of the reasons why I wanted to take the number out instead of doing that maximum minimum is because we function differently than that. And so then you all had noted that you'd like to have a minimum of three. So this could just dovetail on what you're saying is that we do meet outside of, or we could kind of put it in there. But that, I think that was, you all felt better knowing there would be three people on a committee. I'll be honest with you, that still didn't make sense to me when I got home and looked at it because that's not how we run the committee meetings. But if that's what you all wanted, that's what I thought was the right thing to do. That's what the board wanted. So it's definitely, I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's something we need to think about as well.
Yeah, I think things like that would be appropriate to talk about as we do these.
One of the things we talked about at the retreat was not so much doing away with the committee structure, but to have a work session instead of a committee meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And use the work session
so that
the work session we'd all talk about a given issue that's before under a finance and budget or executive, whatever the committee is, and then everybody get to vote to put that on the agenda for the upcoming board meeting. That's the way local governments handle it. So,
and the other thing I've heard, and any of you chirp in on this, but is put a little more process into these agendas so that any board member, staff people can get together and decide what the agenda needs to look at rather than having it sort of fall out of the air every quarter.
And what was interesting about the bylaws is some things sound like they'd be really good, but because of the size of our board at 11, it's a little hard to do some of these other things. When I was reading, I was like, oh, that'd be great. That might be a good thing to suggest. You know, and then I think, oh, no, it needs to be a bigger board. So, I mean, it was kind of, our size board is a little bit odd, too, when you think about it, about how to keep people involved, but also not to have people on like four committees, those kind of things. So it was also being aware of the time as well. It's a little harder to do with an 11-person board.
That being said, Randy gave me a book not too long ago. It's the Team Genius is the title of it, and it's really an academic study of teams, boards being one example, and that the ideal number for a committee or board is probably somewhere between 7 and 12. So I think we should all be thankful we are on a board of our size, where we can be a little bit more nimble. So it does make things like this more difficult than having a committee. We all got to work several committees.
Speaking as a guy who has a board of trustees of 40 people, if this is the best thing in my life right now, it's 11 folks.
Chairman, you need the endorsement. I'll give it to you.
If I could make a suggestion, if you find a copy of Robert's Rules of Order, newly revised, there's a really good section in that on small boards, and you would be defined as a small board. So there might be some ideas for you that would be useful.
And I also, Julie and I laughed because I made up a little binder because I'm a binder girl, so that whenever this went forward or the next person that worked on this would not have to start from scratch. So it includes all the books and all everything, the kind of step and the processes we went through and that kind of stuff, so that it would help somebody in the future. And I also separated that with the policy and procedure of the suggestions that have already been gathered. Because I actually, believe it or not, we have quite a few people are WKU alumni that are on other boards in this state of Kentucky. I guess I never thought if you were a WKU alumni, well, you want to be on Murray State's board, but I have a very good friend who helped me get some information, and people have been real helpful when I've been asking about how to do things. So I have all that gathered for when you work on the policy and procedure, when you set that committee, that I can at least give so they don't have to start from scratch. Mm-hmm. And there was some good suggestions from Deborah on one of that Murray State one that we talked about that would be a good reference to start with, because it kind of lays it out. And they had updated theirs a little more recently, so that was another reason why we looked at it as well.
And not to complicate things too much, but as you've heard me say, I think at the last meeting too, we will be going through a board assessment process in the next few months. We're putting together a self-assessment that we'll send out to everyone to fill out, and then we anticipate probably bringing someone in from Vanderbilt to help facilitate a discussion on our board assessment sometime early in the year, before spring or by spring. So,
have we contacted AVG to, I think at the last meeting, didn't we?
Yeah, we talked about that. We did contact them, and they weren't going to be available till
not in the time.
It wasn't going to work, and President Caboni knows some folks at Vanderbilt that do that sort of thing, and seems like a nice way to do that.
Can you incorporate the comments?
Separate process.
Does anyone else have any comments about any of this they want? Because right now I'm going to start thinking about an ad hoc committee for this policy thing, and we'll get that going. Everybody will look at the bylaws information that we have, and Freddie, you will share with our board attorney some of the things that...
Just the boring stuff.
And then we'll bring those two processes along together sometime early in the year. Hopefully have another discussion, possibly a first read on both of them by February. That may be ambitious, but... And the policy... stuff could be limited to one or two things right now and be added on to it.
Bill, most of them are a page and a half. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not. Basically, what Deborah removed out of there is very similar to what they had. I mean, if we went back and mirrored it, it would be about basically the same. So, and then when you started looking at examples, it was the same way in those policy procedures. It was very much some of those same. So it's going to be, if you start looking for references or other examples, I think you'll start seeing that it might be a little easier process. Now, the thought process will be a little bit different, because we want to need to, really think, be able to let Dr. Caboni do what he needs to do, but at some point have a limit or some things like that, because we can't control it, and we don't want to, like, put a limit on waiting. Everything, every decision, that'd be crazy.
Any other comments? Julie, anything else?
No.
You want to say? Okay, we have a number of announcements there as far as our calendar events for 2019. And we look forward to our Christmas celebration tonight with the President and Casey.
Mr. Chair, just as we finish up the year, I'd like to first thank the board for its service, but also to turn our attention to one of the two most important days of the year, and that's tomorrow, when we celebrate all that we do and why we do it. And that's our recognition ceremonies for our December graduates, and I look forward to celebrating with them and you and their families, their accomplishment. It is the reason we do everything else we do for the other 364 or so days out of the year. So,
very nice. And everyone had a copy of an editorial from last week's Courier Journal, and hope everyone can read that. As we all know, we've got to be champions for higher education. We're in a battle, and anytime, any place that we can speak to the importance of a liberal arts degree, we all need to do that. Any other business?
Move to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All those in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed, like sign.